Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode number 100 of the Free Cities Podcast. 100 episodes is finally upon us. We were wondering actually how to celebrate this milestone, and we went through a few ideas amongst the Free Cities Foundation's team. High on the list, of course, was a special celebrity guest, which I had, but then which fell through and is unable to record in time. So the next best idea we had was to get back my first ever guest on the pod, the CEO of the Free Cities Foundation, Peter Young. In hindsight, of course, this was by far the best decision because this episode is going out just 2 weeks before our big conference in Prague. And that makes it a perfect opportunity to look back over the last 100 episodes and look forward to the wealth of new speakers and projects which are coming in a few days' time in Prague. So my gift to you on this 100th show is the prospect of the following interviewees to look forward to over the next few months. Ott Vatter, who served as managing director at the pioneering governmental startup e-residency under the Republic of Estonia. Guacamo Zamagni, who's building an ANCAP community in Argentina. Mark Lutter and Carl Peterson from the Charter Cities Institute. Mikkel Thorup, the founder of the Expat Money Show, author and economist Per Byland. Patrick Hibbert, CEO of Eco Villages. Grant Ramunt, the founder of Ocean Builders. They're the guys building sea pods currently. And Alex Voss from Tipolis, someone who I've been meaning to speak to for ages, author of Strategies for Liberty, Free Cities and Bitcoin. There will, of course, be plenty of returning guests, favourites such as Titus Gabel, of course, Vera Kichanova, our own chief economist, Jan Mazowski, who was on the podcast a year and a half ago, Gabriel Delgado from Prospera with an update on what's going on in Honduras, Joe Quirk, of course, from the Seasteading Institute, Efrat Fenningsen. That was a hugely popular episode we have recently. She's coming back. Same Pavla Caron coming back again. And, of course, our very own Free Cities influencer, the new darling of Elon Musk himself, Natalie Danilishin. All that and much more to come. In fact, I'm still sorting out interview spaces as we speak, so there will be plenty more. So, how can I sum up the last 100 episodes? Well, it's been a phenomenal journey for me, which has taken me all over the world, meeting exceptional people who really are, in my opinion, pushing the boundaries of what is possible in the market of living together. Of course, I feel very fortunate to have had this opportunity to learn out loud about all this stuff on this podcast. And also thankful that you've been able to come along for the ride with me. To be honest, before I started this podcast, governance wasn't high on my list of interests. But as the months have gone on, I've realized that it's one of the most important aspects of the freedom that we are all searching for in the world. It's also one of the aspects that is often at the heart of so much conflict and dispute. If only it was as simple as live and let live. But we all know that it's not, and in my opinion, never will be. So we carry on discussing, building, and creating parallel systems into which people can voluntarily opt in. My biggest lesson from the last 99 episodes, I suspect a lot of you are going to groan when you hear me say this, you probably know it already, but you don't have to vote on everything. You don't need a say in everything. Now, this penny finally dropped for me on our trip to Dubai filming the SEZ documentary. There's no voting in Dubai, in the same sense that there's no voting at Apple or Samsung. If you don't like the new Galaxy Z Fold 6 phone, you don't try and vote on the way the phone's being built. you buy the iPhone 16 Plus and you get on with your life. Dubai is a product that people are choosing, and they will keep choosing it until they don't like it anymore or until there's a better option for them to choose. This is the future of governance that I think a lot of us here are aiming for. A multitude of innovative places all over the world competing for you as a customer. In my opinion, there are no utopias in the future. There's no end to this road. But right now, what there is, in our present, is a world in which you can choose to work on a project that you believe in, a project that you can offer up to your fellow human beings to join in with or not. It's up to them. And then after that, and I've said this many times before, I believe it's just a case of turning up each day and putting in the work. Never forget, you get to work on what I would say are some of the most interesting projects currently on the planet at this particular and incredible time in history. And I, for one, am extremely grateful for the opportunity. So here's to another 100 episodes of this podcast, and to all the future pioneers I'll be talking to over the next 2 years, I salute you. And I've loved hanging out with you all over the last 99 episodes. To be honest, I keep thinking, what a time to be alive. Anyway, I will hopefully be seeing many of you in a few days in the wonderful city of Prague for our conference, Liberty in Our Lifetime. Tickets still available, of course, blah, blah, blah. Come and say hello if you see me. Oh, and I almost forgot. Nosta comments from this week. That rousing speech made me forget my duties here. Anyway, we had Anon talking about our latest episode with David Beauville, 100%. Bon said, Mr. Ben Gunn, ladies and gentlemen, great conversation, guys. Really enjoyed it. That's episode 97. That got a lot of interest. And actually, as we speak, one of our top five most listened to episodes. Short Fiat said about that same episode with Ben Gunn, a great podcast. Really interested, oh, and this is a long one, really interested in the concept of building intentional communities. It seems that if you want to build a community that uses a common currency and has a common ideology, then the thing to do is build it around Bitcoin. Bitcoiners will come and stay if they know that Bitcoin is being used as the currency. The shared values of Bitcoiners are generally very strong and cohesive. There really is no need to engage with altcoin smart contracts that could be rugged at any time. Land ownership can be divided and legally bought and sold within the existing legal structure of whatever jurisdiction the community exists in. Essentially, what I'm proposing is a property development where lots are sold to people with the stated intention that Bitcoin will be used to trade amongst the community members. The community members will likely build shops, bars, cafes, and trading systems that use Bitcoin. There is no need to reinvent the legal structure of property ownership using smart contracts. It's interesting to hear that so many intentional communities have failed in the past. I would like to research this more, but my first instinct would be that many of the communities created in the past were philosophically against money. Sadly, civilizations depend on money to keep account of the contributions of individuals and to operate as a fair medium of exchange, enabling the specialization of production. It is possible that the denial of the need for money as a key element of civilization has been the reason for the 90% failure rate of intentional communities. Perhaps Bitcoin fixes this. Not sure about the vilification of money being a problem, but I would certainly say that you can base the structure of your community around Bitcoin. You don't need to use an altcoin. And if you want to hear us discuss that, check out last week's episode. More comments. We had a lot this week from people, especially talking about the Ben Gunn interview. Again, it's had another little pump. Nosta Paraguay says, and thanks for the 10,000 sats. Great pod chaps. Looking forward to getting one of your houses installed in Paraguay. That's the Ben Gunn episode. Short Fiat also listened to the Ben Gunn episode. A really good story of triumph over adversity. I need to find that same volition in my own life. And finally, Anon about last week's episode. Some interesting stuff here. Some word salad too. Good conversation. Do you know what? I agree with you on the word salad, but don't tell anyone. Right, so that's about it from me for this episode. See you all in episode 101 next week. And in the meantime, for the 100th time, and I never get bored of saying it, all I want you to do, really, honestly, truthfully, is just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Peter Young. Happy 100th episode. What I want to do, since this is our 100th episode, is go back. What I was twiddling my fingers last night thinking about basically the last 99 episodes, basically. And I realized that when you go back through them, I've been on a massive ideological and spiritual and physical journey throughout this 100 episodes. And it really broke down into kind of sections. And I just want to relay them to you and tell me whether you think that this is true or right or wrong or whatever. Because I came into this world very naive. I was, broadly speaking, I was into freedom and I was into Bitcoin mainly. And that's kind of what brought me into the Free Cities ecosystem was Bitcoin. But I've gone through a lot of life lessons in the last 100 episodes, which is basically 2 years. So look, I want to break it down for you. So we began in El Salvador, and that's when it all started. And that was a Bitcoin connection. And then we went to Prospera. Now in Prospera, I didn't really know what was going on. Ricardo Gonzalez was a great help. He kind of explained it to me. But really, I was grasping at straws. I didn't really know what was going on. Now, after that, we came back. Then we went to Prague and we started interviewing all those kind of freedom-minded people in Prague. Do you remember? Like, and a lot of the Bitcoiners like Max Hillebrand or Caroline King, you know, homeschooling. It was all these kind of, it was introducing the sort of libertarian, the freedom-minded side. And then also all the crazy parallel Nepalis people, Josef Tetek, Elena, you know, all the really interesting freedom-minded sort of techie people, which are, for me, Prague, there was a real interesting realization that Prague was a place where all that kind of stuff started. Then we went to Poland, which was capitalism, really kind of like edgy libertarians, you know, like, now imagine my brain going through all these things. Learned a bit about Austrian economics. Then we went to Portugal, Students for Liberty. Then we went to Montenegro and visited, firstly, a real, you know, community of like-minded people at Montelibro, which was a massive eye-opener. Then Zuzalu, which was like, oh, wait a minute, there's this whole other side of the Free Cities movement, the kind of like Web3 kind of pop-up city lot. Then we had our own conference last year, which was the first, I think, really kind of exciting Free Cities conference where there was a real buzz. And then I had learned about Sark there. That's when I actually got really deep down with seasteading and actually convinced of seasteading. Yeah. Prior to that, I thought it's just some crazy idea. Joe Quirk, thank you, and Mason as well. And then eventually after that, I was looking at my little list, we did the whole Dubai thing, the SEZ thing, which was another massive step for me when I realized that special economic zones and free cities are really intricately connected. Didn't get that at all. Then we went to Liberland, which was just insanely crazy. Ended up at Prague, the Bitcoin conference. Now, actually, because the podcast carries a lot of weight, we could actually interview pretty much whoever we wanted. So we got some pretty heavy Bitcoiners on there. And what's coming up next in 4 weeks is the next Prague conference, which is something I'm super excited about. There's a whole new different bunch of people coming now, which is great. to see, because I'm going to hopefully be interviewing everyone. So that's been my journey, this kind of journey from really not knowing what's going on to understanding the sort of libertarian side of it, then the kind of like Austrian economic side of it, then the whole spectrum of free cities, then moving on to the SEZ thing, and then resulting in this kind of, I've got a relatively rounded idea about free cities now, kind of like what it means, what it is, who's interested in it, which ones are realistic, which ones aren't. Is that a journey you recognize in yourself there?
Well, the journey you just described, I've definitely kind of been with you on that journey, because I've listened to every single podcast episode.
Have you?
Yeah.
You nutter.
Yeah, every week. That's, and I've been there for a lot of the interviews.
You have, yes.
So there's definitely been that progression that you described of starting out as just a curious person that wants to know what's going on. And I think something that listeners might not know about is that you come from a journalistic background, mainly in photography and filmmaking, working for very large publications. And I think for you, working with the Free Cities Foundation has always been like a passion project, something that you're doing because you find it interesting, you find it could potentially be a meaningful thing and a good thing for the world if it really takes off. And I think the sense that I got from those beginning episodes is that you were coming at this with a pretty open mind. Like, you were willing to be convinced that free cities are a great thing, but you're also willing to hear the counter arguments and be convinced by the counter arguments. And I think it's been interesting for me to see that progression from like quite open-minded at the beginning to, I guess, remaining open-minded, but also as you go on, armed with more facts and more counter arguments. So when people are making the case against the ZAs in Honduras, for example, saying, hey, but like, surely we should be focusing on national governments, not setting up little zones that have their own rules and regulations. Couldn't the governments just trounce on all their rights? You're kind of coming back with those arguments about, you know, the CAFTA-DR treaty with Honduras and other Caribbean countries in the US, and like all these kind of counter arguments. So it's been really interesting to see how the podcast has developed as your kind of involvement and number of people that you've interviewed has developed as well.
What you're saying is I've become radicalized, basically, which I feel like in a way I have. I mean, because going to Prospera, and a part of me still thinks this, is I find it hard to separate the free cities concept from the kind of neo-colonial gated communities thing. It's a real, and I think that's a good thing, because I think I need to be sharp on that. Because that's what a lot of people think, especially when you go to that side of the free city spectrum, the kind of like free private cities thing. You know, I find, you know, you're right. I come from the media, which is a very particular political slant in the media on the whole. You're surrounded by people who think that a private city is a terrible idea, because who's gonna monitor what goes on in there? You know, and I probably would have thought that to a much larger degree, at least, than now, when I think, yeah, but who's monitoring what the government are doing? You know, and you know, another one of my really big journeys has been with democracy, which is insane. It's crazy that there was this idea, the democratic system, that I'd never challenged before, until it was a good halfway through, like 50 episodes, maybe even more. I remember when it suddenly started occurring to me that democracy is not the pinnacle of governance that I thought it was, you know. But you know, like, yeah, I mean, you've always known that, right? You've just kept quiet about it. When I came into this, you were already on board with pretty much all of it, weren't you? The libertarian stuff, the big talking points, right? Or what's your journey been over the last 2 years?
Well, my journey has been, I came to the Free Cities Foundation because the idea of it appealed to me. I started studying the Austrian School of Economics from about the year 2017, 2018, when I was living in China. I was working for the British Embassy for most of my sort of central years in China. And so in that role, I was exposed to a lot of the mainstream arguments about economics, how development happens, how we should judge whether a certain state-funded intervention is impactful, and how we measure the impact. And because I was kind of working at the coalface, like delivering these projects and applying for funding from the government to deliver things and seeing the actual outcomes, I became conscious of a disparity between what was described in these nice reports and what was actually happening. And so that gave me a bit of a skepticism around some of the theories that underpinned why the government should be intervening in all these policy areas. That's what led me to the Austrian School. And the Austrian School really makes a very different economic case to the kind of political mainstream, which is actually that the functions that we normally associate with government could actually be provided by the private sector more effectively. A lot of the arguments around public goods and market failures actually have some logical problems with them. And if you think that the Austrians have a good case for that, that then leads you to alternative ideas. And I saw that Titus Gebel was putting forward like a practical model for implementing the ideas of the Austrian School in the real world. So I thought that was a really interesting thing. And it's only like with time and partially on the journey with you, because we've been together for lots of the trips where you've recorded the podcast. It's been with time that I've really like fleshed that out into, okay, what does that mean in terms of the laws, the regulations, the treaties, the businesses that are setting up? Why are they setting up in these zones when they could set up somewhere else? And it's been a fascinating journey so far, and one that I'm sure will continue to develop on.
But what's been, if anything, a realization that you've had since, you know, this journey began? Something that you didn't realize before? Something like, for me, there's been some absolute obvious things, you know, like the whole, like democracy was one of them, like the social contract, never heard of that before. And now I'm like, yeah, there isn't really a contract, actually. And I obviously, things like that, I sensed them before. I sensed that, but I never even thought about it. And, you know, more recently, the SEZ thing, the special economic zone thing, and realizing that, you know, this progression from special economic zones to free cities is so obvious. And as far as I can tell, so happening before our very eyes. It just, we're quite at the sharp end of the wedge. But did you have any things where you've kind of slowly, something's distilled out of you and you realize, oh yeah, yeah, by working in the space, by doing all the things you've done in the Free Cities movement?
I'd say there's two kind of key changes in my thinking. The first is that I've realized that you can have a pure model that would work great in theory that you can't immediately realize because of the system that exists in the rest of the world. And I kind of previously thought, well, also like you being into Bitcoin and studying Bitcoin and thinking, oh, Bitcoin is just easily going to outcompete fiat currency because it isn't inflationary and fiat currency is. So over time, people that store their wealth in fiat will lose it, and people that store in Bitcoin will gain. But over time, I started to see actually there's a lot that the current system can do to restrict and inhibit what people who are attempting to introduce market solutions want to do. So I'm thinking of stuff like blacklisting of jurisdictions. You know, if the previous, some of the criticism we get in the libertarian community is like, if libertarianism is so great, it's going to make everyone so wealthy and do all the things that you say, why hasn't everyone done it? And you can kind of point to some examples that are pretty strong, like Hong Kong. And you can say Hong Kong was able to radically transform the well-being of millions of Chinese people, about 7 million, mainly Chinese people, some Vietnamese, some others, within, you know, say 2 to 3 generations. Singapore, the same. But then you can have an argument around those and say, actually, those, they're kind of like just minarchist states. They still have taxation, they still have regulation, they have less welfare for people, but, you know, they're kind of just like the Western welfare state light. So why hasn't anyone actually introduced the free private city model that Titus outlines? And the answer is that if you try stuff like that, if you say we're going to eliminate income tax and have a fee for people that want to be in our zone, you end up getting blacklisted by all the other countries, organizations like the European Union. You might get blacklisted as a sort of tax haven by the US government or other international organizations. We've seen that quite prominently with the situation in Dubai recently, where Dubai introduced a 9% corporation tax, which previously it had 0%. So you could go to Dubai, you wouldn't have to pay any income tax, you wouldn't have to pay any corporation tax. There's only a few like smaller local taxes and taxes on imports and exports. But the reason that Dubai brought that in is because of international pressure to conform to the international standards, because they got greylisted as a financial territory. So this has made me much more sympathetic to projects like Prospera, who some people in the libertarian community say, hey, hang on, they're not going far enough. They still want to have AML checks on people's finances. They still want to have some forms of regulation for things. They should just be going full private city. They still want to have like a 5% income tax. They still want to have a 2.5% land tax. Actually, my view now is, yes, I agree that in theory, in a perfect world, in a world where there was no incumbent system, rather, we would be able to introduce these pure systems. But in the world we currently live in, we need to try and get as close to them as possible. And often the real physical projects we see in the world are led by people who have got the right ideas and are just trying to get as close as possible to that idea within the real world. That was one realization. And then just quickly, the second realization was like basically just fleshing out the practicalities of what all these projects mean. Like, I knew about them in theory, but there's a lot of kind of detail that's been added on what they actually are practically delivering, which has made me really excited and hopeful.
What have you learned any new kind of worries other than what you've just explained there? Because, well, I mean, talking about not going full private city or full libertarian, I understand that, but there's a fine line, isn't there, between stopping yourself doing something and actually pushing the boundary. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Prospera as well, because Prospera really is going through the thick of a very deep and profound lesson at the moment. And I think all eyes are on Prospera because currently the government have now said, yes, you're illegitimate. And everyone's now holding their breath, wondering what's going to happen. I know from the guys at Prospera and from the guys at Morazan that they know that actually they can't do anything. But we're talking about governments here with immense power to just steam in and, you know, like take over.
Yeah.
And that's always, when I talk to very well-respected critics of free cities, that's always the thing they say to me. Look, it doesn't matter. You're always in someone else's country. You're always going to be in someone else's country. It doesn't matter what you implement in law, because laws get broken by states. That's what they do, you know. So what's your opinion on that? And so, with reference to Prospera as well, because you probably know more about it than me.
My opinion on it is, there's certainly a lot that a host nation that's trying to disrupt a free private city-like project can do to achieve that. You can look at what's happened in Prospera as a case study. So even before this recent ruling by the Supreme Court of Justice that says is are illegal, Prospera had been facing a number of different issues. For example, there is no law in Honduras that says the national banks of Honduras must grant finance to anyone that asks for a loan, because they're, you know, nominally market companies that can assess individual loans based on their merit. But all of the bank accounts of all the businesses in Prospera have been shut down that are with national Honduran banks, and all of the loan projects, all the loans that were granted previously under the previous administration to Prospera have been denied. And Prospera argues that this is under pressure from the government, basically. You know, the government has got these kind of influence over these national banks, and they're saying to them, don't give any bank accounts or any loans to Prospera-based businesses, Prospera-based projects. And that sort of stuff can be pretty disruptive, and it has been disruptive, but it hasn't stalled the investment. It hasn't stalled them from doing other things. And this kind of issue, this and stuff like the Honduran government is attempting to impose important export tariffs on businesses that are in Prospera that should be exempt from them. This kind of thing is the basis for the case that Prospera is bringing to ICSID, which is a arbitration body under the World Bank. They're suing the Honduran government for $10.6 billion, which is twice the two-thirds of the GDP of annual GDP of Honduras. And we will see, I guess, in real time, whether that arbitration rules in Prospera's favor and what the consequences are. If it does rule in its favor, there should be pretty severe consequences for Honduras. So it will be a very important test, I think, for this whole free private cities idea.
When you say the consequences will be dire,
yeah,
what kind of thing would they expect?
So ICSID is a arbitration body under the World Bank that various countries, including the UK, Switzerland, United States, many developed countries have signed up to. And one of the provisions is that in order to enforce the rulings of ICSID, you are able, those countries that are member signatories of this agreement are able to seize the assets of a foreign government in another country. So for example, if the UK were to say, get sued for $1 billion, and they said, no, we're not going to pay $1 billion to the company that was successful in the case, Switzerland, the US, whoever could steal UK assets, such as the money in UK government bank accounts held within Switzerland or within the US, US dollar deposits within the Federal Reserve, to, in order to claim back that money. Or if there's like a national airline, for example, that has got a base within Switzerland's airport that's owned by the UK government, Switzerland, under the treaty, would be able to seize those assets.
It just struck me, that's not very libertarian, is it? This is a bit it's a bit of a dichotomy, isn't it, really? You're talking...
I'd say it is libertarian.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's about respecting private property rights. Libertarianism is not about pacifism. It's not a pacifist ideology. It's saying that you shouldn't aggress against people that don't aggress towards you. So you can aggress in according to kind of libertarian thinking, you can react to someone in order to claim back your property if it's stolen from you, but you're not allowed to initiate unprovoked aggression. So basically, according to an agreement, everyone said, these are the rules we're going to play by. Like, if I invest in your country, say the rule says my investments are subject to a 20% corporation tax. Say that's in the treaty. It isn't in this particular treaty, but just say theoretically that is. If the country says, no, we're changing that, it's now 40%, well, that completely changes the calculus of your investment. And the company can legitimately say, hang on, that's not what we signed up to. I've been letting your companies do business here for 20%. Your company's been doing business in this country over there for 20%. Like, why are you allowed to change it? So in retaliation, they can seize assets in order to claim back what they've lost from the change. So in that sense, everyone has consented. So it's kind of voluntarist in the libertarian sense. And you're simply taking back, you're simply taking into your own ownership property of someone else that you've essentially been a custodian of for the time being. So that's basically what the agreement sets out to do. And I do think it is actually libertarian in its nature.
Fair enough. I mean, I suppose the bit that makes me feel uncomfortable is that you're basically leaning on a bully to sort of like sort your, you know, take things from someone else, please. Because, but yeah, I suppose. I mean, the whole suing the government for, what was it, 10 billion?
Yeah, just over 10.6.
Is an unfortunate thing, because I've seen it reported in various places around the world that, you know, it creates a really terrible narrative that, oh, look at this, they're trying to bankrupt the country kind of thing. Whereas you and I both know it's just what they have to do according to the agreement. You know, like, you know, if you want to challenge the government, you don't go in there with guns. You have to challenge them legally, and you have to challenge them based on the loss of earnings. That's the way they do it, which worked out to be 10 billion or whatever, you know. Yeah. But it's a really unfortunate situation for literally everyone, because it, you know, I don't know anyone inside Prospera who wants to sue the government. They don't want to sue the government. They just want the government to leave them alone. They're having a great time. They're doing really well. Lots of happy people. You know, a lot of the things that get spoken about by the Honduran government, according to what I've found out as well, have no basis in truth. And yeah, it's just that it's not a good thing at all what's going on there. I don't think even the government wins out. You know, it's a really terrible situation for everyone concerned. But I mean, on a positive note, I think everyone I've spoken to in Honduras says it'll be fine. I don't know. Have you got the same feedback?
Not exactly. There is, what I'd say is that the people that are being sued, that are working within the ZAs, have taken an attitude of like being resilient to this, not just giving up and saying,
yeah,
you're trying to claim our assets, so we're going to give them up and we're going to stop what we're doing. You know, they're invested in what they have created, and what they've created is amazing.
It is.
Like, we've been there. It was a relatively early stage, but to see just online all the stuff that's been going on since, all of these, you know, world-renowned speakers that are going to this island, all the new businesses that have been set up. There's 220 businesses in Prospera now. There's 2,000 residents. There are companies working on drone technology, gene therapy. They've got loads of great nearshoring stuff for US companies setting up offices there and running operations there. It's really like they're doing what they set out to do. They're creating well-paying jobs for Honduran people so that they've got opportunities to stay near to their families and not have to migrate to another country and live with split families for the rest of their life. And it's kind of difficult not to be a bit exasperated when you see the positive impacts.
The only thing I've ever come across which is a legitimate complaint is thinking about local people in Roatan who don't want a big development next to them, and I've got no answer to that. And that would, if you know where I live, if someone was building a big city or a big something close to me, I'd be pissed off with it. And but that, I suppose, that is part of life. I mean, there's not a lot you can do about that, and that's not to say that many people are saying that, but that's the one thing I've come across, which I go, yeah, fair enough, that's true. Whereas everything else, it's like what you've just said. I'm like, most of it is just based on untruths, like the neo-colonial stuff. It's like, you know, as we know, it's Hondurans and it's Central Americans, and it's not like full of expats smoking cigars saying, well, hey, we've made so much money, you know. And Morazan, even more so. Morazan is blue collar Honduran workers and with their families living there, you know. It's no, I think Joyce is the only outsider that lives there, isn't she? I think
There's Alex Ugorji's also living there. There's a handful of foreigners that live there, but it's mainly,
yeah.
I think they've got about, there's 64 houses that are fully occupied now. Yeah. And yeah, I think about 63 of them are occupied by Honduran families.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to speaking to Massimo at the conference coming up, because he will have an interesting take on the whole thing. And I hopefully by then there'll be a little bit more, a little bit more visibility for what the government might do, because really they've put themselves in a little bit of a corner now where they have to act, don't they, really, or not. What do you think?
You mean the people running the ZS have to act?
No, I mean the government. Honduran government have basically declared this very substantial claim. And it's not enough to now just do... Well, I mean, I know governments, they often say things and don't do anything about it. But they've pretty much backed themselves into a corner now.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going to likely do something about this. So... exactly how it's going to play out and what actions are going to be taken remain to be seen. Massimo, the founder of Ciudad Morazan, the other ZA in Honduras, he's generally taken the view that it's necessary to renegotiate the ZA legal framework, partially because there's a certain media narrative that's played out in Honduras around what the ZAs are. And there are certain kind of branding associations with it that are really difficult to overcome, even though they're based on lies. Misunderstandings.
And lies.
And lies and fake news, false information, whatever you want to call it. Stuff about the ZAs being an expropriation risk. You know, the ironic thing is the government of Honduras themselves, within their constitution, is allowed to expropriate the land of people. But Prospero in its constitution says, we are not allowed to expropriate land. The ZA, the confusion came about because the ZA law itself allows for expropriation, technically, which none of the people running the ZAs currently want. So they've created their own article saying, this is not something that a power we want to have. And you also, there are Honduran government bodies that have looked at the issue of expropriation and come to judgments, and they've said no expropriation has taken place in the development of any ZA. So, but this kind of was, there was an incident in 2021 where Eric Brimmen gave a speech about this topic, and it was kind of misinterpreted. Eric Brimmen, the CEO of Prospera. And then ever since then, this kind of whole story about the ZAs has gained this bad image. And there's also the perception that it's associated with Juan Octavio Hernandez, the previous president of Honduras, who is currently in the US due to drug trafficking charges. So he has faced lots of corruption charges and is not a popular person. So basically... there is this kind of baggage that comes with the term ZA. And Massimo's view has been, let's renegotiate the whole ZA thing. Let's try and keep the key freedoms, like the ability to provide your own security services, like the ability to have run your own businesses independently, that the ZAs currently have, but, you know, allow some concessions and allow for a rebrand.
Parallel structures. Was it opt-in to freedom? Those were the last two sort of taglines for the conference. What is it this year?
From vision to reality.
Oh. And what's the thinking behind that?
So parallel structures, our first theme, was about the idea that you would not try and change an existing system from within, but... that you would create something new yourself and allow people to voluntarily opt in. So that was what we started off with. And that was, we had a great set of talks on that about all these different parallel structures people are setting up at our first conference, the first conference that I ran in 2022. And then the next year we'd had Opt Into Freedom. And that was kind of about the fact that becoming part of a free city isn't about running off and starting your own Galt's Gulch, a kind of secluded libertarian community. It's about opting into something exciting and kind of being involved in the older legacy system if you can, but like joining new networks, becoming part of a community that gives you additional possibilities, becoming an e-resident of Prospera whilst also remaining a citizen of your home country, about acquiring second citizenships in other countries so that you've got ability to kind of leverage more international connections and live a better life for yourself, your family, and your community. And this year we've chosen another theme which is quite crucial to the whole mission of the Free Cities Foundation, which is from vision to reality. And the reason we chose that is because quite a lot of libertarian conferences are theoretical in nature. It might be like, you know, keynote speech. Let's do a talk on how the Austrian business cycle theory works and why we get recessions and what happened in 1929 with the Great Depression and the theory as to why it happened from an economic perspective. That's all great and interesting stuff. But I think what has differentiated our conference from other conferences is that we've always been focused on, okay, so given that we ascribe to these libertarian principles, how can we put them into practice? Like the we've always given the most prominence in our conference to people that are delivering practical projects. And this year we've got about 15 or so practical projects that feature, spanning Latin America, Africa, Europe. We even got one in Philippines this year. And so we wanted to make the theme of the conference from vision to reality, because it's one thing to have a great idea about something, but we really wanted to put the spotlight on people that are entrepreneurs taking practical action to make them happen.
I'd never heard of that one in the Philippines. ArcPad. What do you know about it so far then?
ArcPad is a seasteading company.
Ah, so good.
The projects that feature, some of them are actual jurisdictions like Prospera, like Ciudad Morazan, like SARC. Some of them are companies that are deploying certain technologies in a specific place. So Ocean Builders over in Panama is one. Like, they don't have an autonomous jurisdiction, but what they are doing is building physical sea pods that could become eventually part of an autonomously self-governed seasteading community. But they are building the prototypes in Panama and deploying them into Panama, and you can go and stay on an Airbnb sea pod in off the coast of Panama if you wish.
Already you can do that.
I'm sure Grant will tell us the specifics at the conference.
Wow, we need to do that. We need to do a pod from a seastead.
We need to do a pod from a pod, don't we?
Yes. I'm seeing another one there that I've never heard of, down somewhere in, looks like almost in Argentina, Los Propietarios. What's that?
So this is a libertarian anarcho-capitalist community. Lots of kind of influence of Bitcoiners in this one. Guacamo Zucco is one of the founders of the project. And they are attempting to drive interest in a development within Argentina that has got various plots of land all kind of apportioned and agreed according to a rough plan. And at the conference, they're going to be presenting the vision for this and how they're going to turn that into a realistic project. So basically, you go there, you get a piece of land, you operate still within Argentine jurisdiction, but with Javier Milei in power and with a location that is kind of de facto quite far away from most of the normal government agencies that might be involved, there might be additional freedoms that you can realize by being part of that community. So they're gonna present and offer people the opportunity to join an emerging community in Argentina.
I can see a lot of familiar names here. Of course, Titus Massimo from Morazan, Ivan Coe, talking about his project in the UK, which I did a podcast about him recently, and Stefan Lavera, of course. But there's a lot of new names here. Anyone that you've got your eye on in particular that you're looking forward to listening to or speaking with?
Yeah. So this year we've got, I think there's a range of new projects. So there's one by Mark Lutter. Mark Lutter is the founder of the Charter Cities Institute, and he is working on a project in the Bahamas called Freeport, which would get special autonomous status. I'm hesitant to say too much about these because at the conference is the time that this is the first speech Mark has ever given about Freeport. So there will be information presented there for the first time that I don't currently have. But as I understand, he's managed to obtain substantial investment for building a special zone within the Bahamas. So I'm looking forward to hearing the announcements around that. There's also someone called Carl Peterson, who's going to be talking about a range of projects being developed across Africa, including Fumba Town, which also has some, it's part of Zanzibar, and it has some special autonomous agreements. And I'm hoping this will be the year that we get Sven Lawrence back as well to kind of announce that he's succeeded in the SARC property bid that's been ongoing so far. We know from your conversation with him a few weeks ago on the podcast and a visit I made a month or so ago to SARC to see how it's all going, that he's been able to raise £29 million of funding so far of a potential £30 million. So he's only 4%
away. Only a million away.
He's only a million away.
Open your wallet, mate. Come on.
Any listeners on the pod that want to make up the remaining 4%, let us know. But really, the funding isn't the challenge there. It's coming up with a good deal that the Barclay brothers will accept. So Sven is trying to acquire 20% of the properties on the self-governing Isle of Sark in the Channel Islands between Britain and France. And Sven is a kind of libertarian-minded person who is also a Sark resident. And he's very familiar with the dynamics on Sark and how Sark's population has radically declined since, say, you know, the 1980s, 90s. Basically, it used to get a lot of British tourists going there. And then it became a lot cheaper for people to fly to Spain, Italy, Greece, and people stopped traveling to the much kind of nearer and more culturally similar Channel Islands. So Sark's population dropped off. And the question now is, how can Sark retain some of its, you know, rural idyllic beauty whilst also keeping its population at a level that can deliver something that's attractive for families to want to stay there and not send their children to other parts of the world. So Sven is leading kind of a renovation project where he's going to take some properties that are derelict and redevelop them. And hopefully in the process, you know, attract people that want to be part of Sark's quite libertarian, you know, governance model.
A little bird told me that you were interested in potentially being one of those people. Is that true?
I am interested. I am interested in being one of those people.
You went to see it, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Come on then. What's Sark like? I've never been there.
So it's a small island near to Guernsey. So Guernsey, I believe, has got a population of about 70,000 people. So the size of like a medium-sized British town in terms of population. What struck me about Guernsey is that it's got, like, it seems just very like Britain, but with a lot of the bad bits taken out. Like when you walk down the street, the high street in Guernsey, you have just like some of the nicer, more quaint aspects of life in Britain, but without maybe as many of the social problems and some of the deprivation and economic issues that you get in Britain. And Sark is like a short ferry ride away from Guernsey. And comparing it to Guernsey, it's still very nice and quaint, but you don't have like a big Waitrose. You don't have a high street, but it's, you know, a dirt road. I mean, that makes it sound quite not very appealing, but actually it's quite quaint and reminiscent of a older time. And you've still got a post office, you've still got restaurants, cafes, place you can rent bikes, you've got a supermarket, an HSBC even on the island. It's the kind of place that if you like, I think it would appeal to you, Tim, because it's got some really amazing countryside. It's quiet. It would be a good place for a family. There is a good school on the island, only caters to the ages 5 to 12. But from my perspective, and also, I mean, if you're interested in taxes, they have a one-page tax return. And if you're in a standard, the amount of tax you pay is based on the size of your property, how much land your property takes up. You're probably going to end up paying £4,000 or £5,000 a year in tax in most properties. And they don't want to know anything about your accounts, which if you don't like bookkeeping and worrying, oh, have I claimed the wrong thing for this or this or this in my business? You don't need to worry about it because SART only taxes you on your land. And it's like a one-page thing. How big is your property? They give you a figure.
Well, so, and if you're renting, is that how they work out your tax as well?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
You just rent the smallest property you can find.
Yeah.
Have they got any studio apartments?
So they don't really have that many small properties. The properties market is quite...
Gosh, if Sven does up a building and turns it into, like, you know, tiny little condominiums, you know, really small ones, you'd probably get a lot of people that want to buy them. Yeah. I've heard that they're oversubscribed on the number of people that want to move there.
They are.
And that's even before... That's just on the kind of publicity campaign that they did over the last few years. They've got a waiting list, really. They could fill up the amount of properties that they could renovate. They could fill them up straight away. You know?
Yeah, they've got loads of people that want to move to SARC. The problem is there's not a developed property market. You can't get a mortgage on SARC for a property because the banks don't want to take the risk of taking on something as a deposit for a loan that is not very liquid. If there's no like liquid market where you can just buy and sell a house quickly, that's kind of a problem for a bank because they also don't know how high to value the properties. You know, they can go for, there can be wild swings in what they're worth. And basically what Sven wants to do is help establish that market by bringing new properties onto the market, renovating them, and then, you know, doing some work with the banks to like, you know, guarantee some of the first loans so that some data can emerge within that market so that insurers and banks know how much they should be
valued
at.
So, I mean, SARC, that was one of the big news stories of the year. So is the recent problems that Prosper are facing. What else has been on your radar since last conference a year ago?
Yeah, there's just been a slow trickle of progress in other projects. Like, you know, Montelibro, for example, that we visited, that was part of your podcast journey. And we went there back in, I think it was April last year. Since we were there, I'm told that apartment block that we saw has been completed. They've now got 21 permanent residents, 32 temporary residents. In addition to that, they say about 15 people are going to Montelibro City every day, which, you know, these aren't colossal numbers. These are small community size numbers, but they're making progress. And they're also making progress on stuff like how they deal with disputes. So they've launched their own court service now with a retired judge or a judge of some kind. I'm not sure if the judge is retired or not, but that's apparently already arbitrated on three different cases and solved three different cases within the community. So some of these governance things that we're quite passionate about, the Free Cities Foundation, that make communities go beyond just being real estate developments, have been kind of slowly happening in other places. And so that's been encouraging as well.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised by Montelibro. Like you say, it's a small project. And if you're expecting libertarian paradises to look like Zaha Hadid architects designed them, that's not where we're at this stage in the sort of supply curve of free cities. But what I loved about Montelibro was, number one, the community was awesome. It was a real genuine community. And number two, they built their own roads, which is always an advantage. And like you say, when we were there, they were building buildings, which is a big deal because, you know, this is a fledgling industry, let's call it an industry or whatever it is. And, you know, as we see in all around the world, with Prospera, for example, the problems they're going through now are not almost always first-time problems because we have this industry evolving as we speak. And Montelibro is another version of that. It's not a Prospera model. It's an intentional community. But it's doing it. It's actually, and it will be discovering lots of new problems, I'm sure. I mean, I've just had a conversation in this particular building before you, Peter, and apparently the life cycle of most intentional communities is 7 years. Did you know that?
I think I've heard that one before, yeah.
Right.
Not very long.
I can relate to that. I can definitely relate to that. But so you know, and Montelibro has been around a while, not 7 years yet, but they're using a lot of technology that you would not normally see in the intentional communities of the past. So, and I think a lot of people are excited about those aspects, the way that you can sort of like digitize governance, for example, the platforms you can create that didn't used to exist. And, you know, I've heard a number of people theorizing that this might be the change that a lot of those intentional communities have been looking for because it maintains the community longer when there's a very easy to interact with platform, which is everything you need to know and do. There's no, it's not a complicated thing. It's Prospera is a great example. It's not a complicated thing to interact with, you know. And I know a number of people who've started up businesses there now, and they're like, that was amazing. You know, I'm used to going on HMRC's website and pressing the same key over and over again to get to the next page. You know, I went to Prospera and within half an hour, I had the whole thing set up. You know, and that's the age we live in now, you know. Any other big news stories of the year that spring to mind?
The things that I wrote down were progress in Morazan as well. So I mentioned that, you know, it's just in the background, stuff like, you know, they're building power supplies for the housing with solar paneling, parking lots. They finished those initial 64 units. They've got another 48 on the way. There's been some developments in seasteading as well. We're starting to get new projects on the horizon. There's the ARC pad that are coming and presenting at our conference. They've got ARC Tide, which is another company, Ocean Builders. These are all like developing various technologies for allowing seasteading to become a possibility. There's been quite a lot that's happened over the past year, but not all of it is game-changing like the Prospera stuff. A lot of it is just kind of gradual improvements and gradual development of the existing projects.
One thing I've noticed, there's a lot of new fake news out there. We had a wonderful video drop a couple of weeks ago, which was just the most excruciating thing to watch. Did you see
it? I did, yeah.
Of course you saw it. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that because we've all been through the experience with the mainstream media is that, or with the sort of corporate media, let's call it now. That's what people are saying, isn't it? That it's all fine and well until they report on something you actually know about. And then you realize they haven't got a clue what they're talking about. And someone from independent media dropped the most atrocious video. It was so, even the way it was narrated was just grating. It was the super patronizing to everyone involved and full of misinformation, as far as I could tell. What was your take on it?
Oh, gosh. I think with lots of these independent media productions, they'll come in and they will want to create an interesting story. They'll have a certain idea of the story they want to tell about these developments. And it's much more interesting to claim that the whole thing is run by, you know, shadowy billionaires that are trying to create some sort of, you know, racial paradise that they can retreat to. And, you know, it makes for an interesting story, right? With these big, powerful characters doing these nefarious things. And once you have a few people that start telling those kinds of stories, it then gets repeated, and the people that are making those independent media stories can just, you know, cite previous people that have claimed it, and you just end up getting this narrative that develops. Unfortunately, the narrative that is told is that there are these huge corporate interests behind all of what we're doing, and we're the powerful ones, and they're the ones that are just, you know, the independent journalists fighting for truth. Whereas the sad reality is, we've got some people that have made their own money, that have kind of doing this stuff as a passion project, committing their own money. It's not a money maker for them. They're doing this because they see this huge potential to do something good for the world. And we encounter that all the time through our work. You know, we know that these people are, you know, committing their own resources and time to try and make the world a bit better. But there's kind of there's sort of a narrative around it that it's all has to be self-interested, and it has to be about protecting profits in one way or another. And it's sad, really. And there's a lot of, you know, we don't have to go into the details of all of it, but yeah, there's a lot of just simple, you know, factually incorrect statements made about these projects, what they do, what powers they have, who their backers are, what influence their backers are having on how things go. So
I think it's actually says a lot more about the people commenting on it than actually the people that are doing it, because like you say, these are passion projects. I mean, Morazan's a classic example of, you know, Massimo is ploughing all his own money into that project. And he shed a tear when I was speaking to him before, because he just wants to see this thing happen.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not, I mean, he's got his own independent business that makes,
yeah, he's,
you know, he's doing absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And these projects, they're seed funding them. You know, they're putting money in because they're seeing that, like, yeah, this is actually solving a real problem. Like, Sierra de Morazan's a great example. Like, it's very low income, sort of working Honduran people that are finally getting the opportunity to live in a safe and secure environment where their children can run around and play in the park and not worry about something happening to them. Or they can run a business without worrying about getting extorted by a local gang or even extorted by the local police. They can just live a normal, safe life that a lot of people in certain parts of certain developed countries take for granted. And Sierra de Morazan has been able to do that very successfully on a small scale. And it's just a shame that it's so much easier to tear down and criticize than it is to actually come up with an idea for changing something and making something better. And the inspiring thing about the Free City projects is that although it's still on a modest scale, there's clear evidence. People that go and see these projects can see with their own eyes. Yes, like there are so many people that have been given jobs, and there's so many families that are being kept together. If you go to Prospera's website, they've got 70 different testimonials from people that have been involved in Prospera, which I would encourage listeners to go and just like have a flick through. So it's sad that there is this criticism, but on the inspiring side, I do think that what this stuff shows is that these kinds of governance models that allow more freedom to individuals, companies, and families, rather than placing all the hands in the power of centralized bureaucrats, these systems can be effective. They can attract investment. They can solve real problems. And on a long enough time horizon, that truth is just going to come out. And people are going to see that that's a way that they can solve problems. So although at the moment there is a lot of criticism, I think in the long run, you know, the truth is going to win out and people are going to see that there is this great opportunity.
I think you're absolutely right. And on that note, I'm going to wrap it up because we've got another guest waiting, right? So I can see an ominous shadow out there. Of course, Liberty in Our Lifetime is happening imminently by the time we put this podcast out. And almost certainly you can still buy a ticket and come and visit all your Free Cities friends. It's a great opportunity to network if you're into that. More than that, it's just a great opportunity to connect with people who are actually building things in this space. We do talk a bit of philosophy every now and then, but really we're hands-on people, really love making this thing a reality and making the world a better place. And everyone's welcome. Just wear smart clothes, please.
It's going to be really fun. Yeah, it's Prague, November 1st to 3rd. You can learn about all the Free Cities projects. You can have some great Czech food and beer along the way. There's going to be, on the third day, there's going to be excursions out into town to see various things. There's going to be additional Q&A sessions, like loads of stuff going on. I'd really encourage any of our listeners to come and join us.
And it all happens slap bang in the middle of Prague, in an absolutely gorgeous part of Prague. Very beautiful place. So we'll certainly be there. I hope you will. And if not, tune into this podcast, because afterwards I will be speaking to as many of the people who are speaking at the conference as I possibly can in 7 days or whatever it is I'm going to be there. So look forward to those ones. And thanks for chatting, Peter. It's good to see you again.
Good to be back. Looking forward to Prague.